You all ask great questions. It's really fun to read the questions and think about them, and we're definitely not going to get to all of them again, but so the first one we'll look at is the one that came up this morning, basically, which I framed as, say more about awareness of awareness. One time I was at Shui U Min, and I remember so clearly Sayadaw sitting behind his desk, and he said, "I've been trying to figure out a good way to talk about this." And the analogy that he came up with was very useful for me. He said, what it seems to me, he says, when you wear glasses, you know, you look through glasses and you see the world. The whole way you see the world is through the glasses. And we kind of take the glasses for granted in a way, and we don't notice that we're wearing glasses. So those of you who wear glasses, this probably makes sense to you. If you don't, you kind of have to imagine it. So I have really bad eyes, and you know, when I basically, you know, I can't see faces here. I see blotches of color. And so when I put my glasses on, it's really clear to me, especially in that contrast, that I'm seeing through glasses. But most of the time, I'm not wandering around recognizing that I have glasses on. And Sayadaw said that awareness of awareness is kind of like recognizing that the entire way that we're able to see clearly is because of the glasses. We recognize, and also the contrast, you know, it's fuzzy. It's clear. So something about how the, how I know the world reveals something about the glasses, you know. So if I put somebody else's glasses on, it would be a little distorted. And so I would know that I had a different set of glasses on. And he said, awareness of awareness is kind of like this. We begin to recognize that the entire way that we know what we know comes through the mind, comes through awareness. And here, awareness is more in the realm of the aggregate of consciousness than mindfulness, because the mind is working all the time, and we, you know, it's like this function of consciousness is working all the time, and these five aggregates together are functioning, and this is how we know the world, through these functionings of mind. And so beginning to be aware of awareness is recognizing to some extent that the whole way we know the world, we know experience, is through the workings of our mind. In my experience, the experience of awareness of awareness, I use a visual for this, is it's not, and we sometimes perhaps think about looking at something. So, you know, this is a way that we use awareness. Often we use visual metaphors for. And the Buddha did too. He used the metaphor of seeing for becoming aware. And we do use that metaphor, and it kind of feels like we're looking at something, you know, so we're over here and we're looking at something. And so we think if we want to become aware of awareness, that it's like turning around and looking like this. It's like turning around and looking at our mind, or awareness looking at itself. And that's kind of like the eye can't see itself. So how can awareness see itself? It's not that kind of a movement. It's not a turning around and looking at. It does feel more, to me like stepping back and understanding that the whole way that we know what's happening is through the functioning of our mind. So it feels more like stepping back, kind of like we can step back and know that we're looking at the world through our glasses. It feels more like stepping back than looking at. So it's, and it also, awareness of awareness doesn't mean that somehow we become just aware of pure awareness, we recognize awareness through how we know the world. So, you know, sometimes awareness functions in different ways. Sometimes awareness is taking in a panoramic experience. Sometimes it focuses. So this kind of movement of focusing on something versus opening to something, that's a kind of the noticing of that distinction as opposed to the recognition of what the panorama is or what the thing we focus on in is. That's more that we understand, oh, mind is taking panorama in. Oh, mind is taking specific in. That's a kind of a stepped back. But we know that based on how we know the experience. Or sometimes it might be that the awareness takes in things like one thing at a time, kind of jumping from one thing to another. And again, we might be interested in the things it jumps to, or in the sense of the mind kind of popping between experiences. Or maybe it's a feeling of a flow between experiences. So these are just different ways that I've seen in my own experience awareness functioning through these different avenues. One thing I've also seen is that while there is a kind of a sense of what it feels like to be aware, and that's the basic question, is that we begin to recognize that we know that we're aware. And it almost might just be an understanding rather than a direct, like, oh, this is what awareness is. It's like we can't like pin it down or say it's like this when we are aware. But there's a knowing. We know that we are aware. And over time, there can begin to be a kind of a felt sense of what that experience is. And yet, my own exploration of this has showed me that any time I think I know what it is, I may miss another way that it is, because I'm orienting to say, oh, that's what it is to be aware of awareness. And it seems like there's different ways it can feel, and different ways it can be experienced. So the question of, do I know that I'm aware? Do you know that you're aware right now? If you know that you're aware, that's awareness of awareness. That's already awareness of awareness. Just appreciate that and let it kind of be an accumulation of understanding that happens over time, as opposed to trying to like pin it down and define it and say, oh, that's what it is. So those are a few thoughts. I'm sure Alexis has more.
Do you want more thoughts? I'll ask him, am I invited to share? But I'm not going to get your permission. I'm just going to say it anyways. So let's see. I was thinking, it's easy to lose track of why something is important, why it's relevant. And awareness of awareness somehow, to me, sounds like a very high attainment and like a goal. Like if I could become aware of awareness, I've gotten somewhere. And because I had that, at least that's what my mind does. The reason why I find that particular statement of awareness is relevant is if we can recognize awareness is working, it becomes easier to support it. Right? It's something that we can know in daily life. Let's say if you can easily begin to recognize when awareness is gone, because you sense that quality when you're the mind is clearly knowing. Yeah, you know the mind is clearly knowing. Then when the mind is not knowing, and it has a kind of impact on your experience, something will trigger the mind to again recognize, oh, it's let me bring the awareness back up. And I think if we were to ask different people how to, to describe what it means to be aware of awareness, we would get a lot of different flavors. And Andre gave a bunch of flavors. And I think in our own experience, it's probably most helpful to just see how it feels to you to be aware or to know or to understand awareness. You know, when is it that the mind is more clearly recognizing this quality is present? And when have I not been knowing it and I've been more knowing the particular object that I'm attending to? So then we're not setting it up. And, you know, as some goal, I was sharing in one of the groups today that sometimes because we language awareness so much, it can feel as if that in itself is the goal or is liberating. And just to remember that awareness allows us to know experiences. It's not liberating in itself. What becomes liberating is what it is that we see, we understand, and then ultimately we let go of habits of mind that aren't serving us, right? That are based in what we say are the defilements. If we're not aware, we can't have those insights. If we're aware, we will see something about our nature, our mind, our habits. And then being aware of awareness simply allows us to know more easily, the state of the mind. Is the mind aware or not? But that's not necessary if one doesn't have that particular familiarity. We can still use whatever object or experience that's arising in the present moment to land on, an emotional state of mind, body, right? So that's my thoughts. Okay, these two I think we're doing together. They're on concentration a bit. Could you describe your body-mind experience of concentration in this style of practice versus other styles of practice? Also, is it true that concentration is said to suppress hindrances? Could you explain? And if the mind is not focusing on one object, but many objects, choiceless awareness, as it is known, how does this affect concentration? Explain how you can be concentrated without being all over the place with awareness. Does this make sense? Yes, it does. Let's see. So for some of you probably have had this experience when we arrive on the retreat, the mind tends to feel like it's not settled, right? A lot of energy, a lot of agitation that we come into retreat with from life. Then we settle in, we're here for a bit, body settles, we connect, little moments with certain objects, and the mindfulness, the awareness is beginning to know something, right? And then the awareness goes, gets weak, and comes back, knowing another object. As the days begin to unfold, if we're not limiting our awareness, and in these instructions we've been saying to open the awareness, what begins to happen is more objects become known. Oftentimes our interpretation is the mind's getting distracted, particularly around thoughts. If we have a view that thoughts mean we're not aware, every time thoughts come into the mind, we can easily interpret that as being I'm losing awareness. So in these instructions is to open, just open, recognize what's arising. And, oftentimes people report that it feels like the mind is getting scattered. It's knowing different objects and it's kind of racing, or it's like the awareness is going to the different sense doors. And I think that's just sort of a stage in the awareness getting more established. As we learn to not necessarily go to the different objects and we stay with the knowing, it's like we're with the screen of awareness, we could say, or the feeling of knowing, and different objects are being known. And the mind can stay very stable in the knowing, even though what it's knowing may be a lot. Right? Maybe a lot of things happening, sounds, emotion, body moving, seeing, but the knowing is stable. Kind of a tangential teaching that I want to share anyways because it's sort of related, and I want to use this moment to offer it. I often give the instruction, and I forgot to here, which is if you're inclined to do so, if you just kind of move your hand like this, feeling the sensations in your hand. Yeah, and we've all been here enough that we probably can feel that quite easily. Aware of the sensations, moving it a little bit faster. Yeah, feeling all that. Now go ahead and shake the awareness off the hand, right, which usually creates some giggles because, you know, and we can move the hand really fast, really shake it, still aware. So speed doesn't impact awareness. But if you were to try to know all of those sensations really discreetly, and, you know, it'd have to be a certain way for the mind to feel like it's being aware, then that view would agitate the mind. But if we have the view that's open, just knowing naturally experiences, awareness can know a lot. And we naturally know a lot of experiences. One of the things, and I'll just end on this point, one of the things that Sayadaw would tell me about concentration is oftentimes we think that concentration depends on the object, like the breath or calm experience, that's what determines concentration. But actually, if you look at the mind, the reason why the breath or calm allows concentration to arise is that the mind isn't getting agitated. Right, so another way for concentration to arise is we look at the attitude. When the mind isn't resisting, pushing away, clinging, or identifying with experience, that wise attitude allows the awareness to be very clear, very open, even with very difficult states. The mind can get very concentrated with right attitude, not necessarily needing a particular object to land on. Both ways are perfectly fine to create for concentration to arise. Both of them are arising because there's no defilements meeting the object. One is to look directly at the attitude, the other is to use the object in a wise way to support concentration. But if we try and use the breath with a lot of craving to get concentrated, what will that do, right? That will agitate the mind, create kind of a disturbance. Is that clear how that happens? So
yeah, I'll say a little bit too about it. I would say that the experience of concentration with the what we would call a samatha practice, what we often call concentration practices, where we bring our attention to one experience and let go of everything else. You know, it's like pay attention to the breath, and the mindfulness functions just in a very dichotomy kind of way. It's either breath or not breath. If it's not breath, you let it go and you come back to the breath. And so that's the practice that's explored with a more of a concentration practice. And that style of practice, partly because, you know, we're cultivating a continuity of mindfulness on one object. And the concentration itself is the continuity of the mindfulness. The experience of concentration has a particular flavor when we bring attention to one object and ignore all other objects. Basically, the experience of concentration in that experience gets very still. So the mind gets still, even the breath can begin to feel still. And so it becomes very, very tranquil. It can become very, very tranquil. And, you know, beautiful, happy, delightful feelings can come into the system with this. And often the kind of the stillness and the absence of activity of mind is what people think of as the concentration. And that's partly why I think there's the misunderstanding when we have open awareness. It's like, well, if it's the stillness of mind and object that is concentration, then this practice can't be concentrating because there's so much happening. But that's just the flavor of concentration when we come to one object. That feeling of stillness and tranquility in the realm of experience, as well as the stableness of the mindfulness. But the concentration is more the stableness of the mindfulness. And so in our open awareness practice, we are cultivating that capacity to be with moment after moment. And that continuity of awareness can build. As Alexis pointed to, if we are more feeling the objects or knowing the objects of experience, it's going to seem like there's not a lot of stillness in the mind. And so if we're thinking of stillness as being the hallmark of concentration, we might think we're not concentrated. There is a kind of stillness in the mind with this kind of concentration, but we can really begin to touch into that when we do become aware of the awareness. We can feel the stability of the awareness itself and the continuity of the awareness, and there can be a lot of sense of stillness and movement. So still mind, moving objects. So there can be a sense of that stillness of the concentrated mind in open awareness. But it may be later in coming, especially if the awareness of awareness piece is a little bit more elusive. And yet one of the other hallmarks of concentration is that the hindrances aren't coming up. And so one of the other things I would say in this case, the hindrances aren't coming up in the observing mind. And so the continuity of mindfulness, it's like if we're sitting here and we know sound, body sensation, pressure, dryness, thought, dryness, pressure, moment after moment, you know what your experience is, there's not a lot of room for reactivity to arise. It's like you're already on to the next thing before there's much time for a reaction to happen. And so you can also begin to be curious about the mind that is recognizing what's happening without a lot of reactivity. So that's a kind of a hallmark, and a lot of you have actually reported that. In some measure, that you're noticing that things are happening, and maybe there's a little bit of reaction, but it's nowhere near what you're familiar with. Like something happens, and it's like, oh yeah, that can be there. Maybe it's more like the feeling of, well, I wouldn't prefer that to be happening, but it's not like we're getting really angry about it. And so that's kind of one of the signs of the mind settling. The reduction of reactivity is one of the signs also of concentration in this practice. And we also, again, as we practice, begin to get a sense of the feeling, the different feeling of the mind in this stable place, knowing a lot of experience, but able to know it and not be essentially yanked out of the present moment by any particular arising. You know, it's like instead of hearing the sound of that motorcycle and then jumping on it and heading down to Santa Cruz, we hear the sound of a motorcycle, and then we hear the sound of a bird, and then we feel a body sensation, and we stay present. You want to add anything more? No. I think I'll start with this one. Can you clarify volition? To me, it implies willing, wanting, or making something happen. Yet mind states arise unbidden. I get that they arise from causes and conditions, some of which may be unknown, but where is the volition in their construction? So the word volition in English, I think, does have this connotation of me making a choice, me doing something, feeling like a conscious choice or a conscious decision. And so that is not what volition refers to. Volition basically, let's see, how can I put this? I think I'll come at it from this direction. So when we are not aware of our mind and what it's doing, maybe frustration arises and we're not aware, but that frustration motivates some response. That frustration makes us jam down a, you know, it's something's not going into a place it's supposed to go, so we start jamming it down. So there's a volition involved in that activity. And we could say that frustration willed that activity. We don't have to consciously will it. It's like the each of those volitional mind states has a kind of a motivating power to it. It motivates action. And that motivation, that kind of the arising of an intention to act is a form of volition. And that volition has a kind of an impetus to it from one of these volitional mind states. So, as I said, you know, anger constructs. So when anger arises in the mind, it tends to construct, a distorted expression on the face, and it may create the arising of pressure and heat. Those activities, we don't do any action without some impulse to act. And that's what's called intention or volition in the Buddhist practice, is this intention to act, this urge to act. And we can see this urge to act arise without me being involved with it. It can kind of get spooky sometimes. You know, it's like, who's in charge here anyway, you know? I'm sitting here and then I suddenly see this urge to stand up and I find myself standing. It's like, who did that, you know? I didn't consciously make that choice, but it happened. So that is a kind of volition. And the importance in the understanding with respect to the Buddhist teaching on this topic is that volition is kind of the engine of what gets constructed in our lives. And when the volitions are, when the volitions are associated with greed, aversion, and delusion, those intentions tend to head us towards suffering. And so love can arise in the system, and love can arise, and love can condition action. Love can condition choice. Compassion arises. Compassion conditions the wish to alleviate suffering. It's not necessarily me choosing to do that. In fact, what I'd suggest is the sense that if for instance, we feel compassion and we're motivated to act, it's like compassion is choosing to act, and then we're taking credit for it. You know, I did that. So it's just a different understanding of the word, I think, than the typical English usage of the word. So I hope that's helpful in describing that.
Okay. How do you take a feeling like depression personally? How do you not take a feeling like depression personally? I've not had full-blown depression, I would say, ever, so I can't speak directly from personal experience. I've had periods that I would say, oh, this is heading straight into depression. And there are some states of mind that are very powerful and will bind us to it very closely, very personally. And I don't want to say that, like as if it's easy to not take something like depression personally. Vitejaniya experienced, according to his own stories, depression a number of times. And he said there were three particularly strong episodes of depression. Each time he faced it, it seemed to weaken it, its grip a little bit. And the third episode, and his momentum was strong enough, he was able to look at it and truly see what depression was for him. Thoughts of himself, views, very unpleasant experiences in the body, emotional states, and seeing it and not taking it personally at that time was possible. But he describes a whole lot of things that he did before that. Like, are you remembering something particular?
No, just, yeah, that it's just a long process.
It's a long process. Well, one thing that he did do that was funny was he said, and I think I was going through something hard, and he was sharing this story the first time I heard about it very early on. And there are these smelling sticks in Burma that you use to, I think, maybe smell, and it clears your sinuses or something. I don't know if we have these here in the States, but there's little, like, you know, it's like a stick this big. And the depression was so strong, pulling his mind to it so, like, over and over again, he couldn't get any space. So, and he was a business person at that time, back and forth, go to the monastery, go back to the world, to his job. And so he was in the marketplace selling, I think, the cloth that their business was. And so interacting with customers, but the depression was really strong, so strong. So the only way he could get out of it, he said, was to take this stick, and you're not supposed to do this, but he just would put it in his nose, and the stick would be sticking out, this thing just hanging there, and you know, the customers would come and, you know, kind of like totally confounded as to what he was up to. And if you know Sayadaw, he would know he does not care at all. It's just whatever someone thinks of him. It's just his personality. You know, he said this was an object that he would use. It needed to be powerful enough to counter the power of the object of depression. Right? So if that contact of the smell was so strong, the mind wouldn't go to the depression. And he was using this as an anchor to steady the mind, concentrate the mind, build momentum, and did lots of things like that until the mind was strong enough to face the depression. Then he could see that depression wasn't self. It was just a phenomenon that he could be aware of. I'll say that, just one more thing I want to add, that there are a lot of things that the way to actually be with it is to notice the sense of self is happening. That's right view. Rather than try not to have the sense of self, is to know, oh, this is hurting, and the mind is caught in this thing. You know, and then again, we're not meeting it with aversion. I shouldn't be having a sense of self. This isn't me. It's more like, oh, I am overwhelmed. And this is what's going on. Right there again, the mindfulness is back and we're not fighting, just open. And that's right view, right attitude. So we meet what we can, take it, you know, and there's times to use strong antidotes. Find your own way. You can experiment, you know, and so if there, but depression, you know, really is, I hear it's just so overwhelming to the mind that just trying to have right view may be difficult. In Seidel's case, he used a lot of concentration to get some momentum first. And once that was there, then he could turn to this, to that phenomenon.
So I would just add that, to just reinforce what Alexis said about Sayadaw's story, that the experience of not taking depression personally, or not taking any strong reactive pattern or habit personally. So like for me, self-hatred was a big thing. And like, how does one not take self-hatred personally? I mean, by its very definition, it's personal. But the seeing of the impersonal nature of it is insight. We don't try to not take it personally to be with it. The being with the whole mess of it creates the conditions for that insight to arise, to that insight to recognize this is conditioned phenomenon. That's an insight. It's not something we can just like turn in our mind and say, oh, I won't take this personally. And so something you can explore is, okay, yep, depression is happening and I'm taking it personally. That's what's happening right now. Bring them taking it personally, as Alexis was saying. This is like noticing the selfing around it. This is depression, and yeah, feels like me. Okay, that's what's happening. That's what it feels like for a me to feel depressed. And knowing when that process, when it's possible to notice that without it spiraling you into the depression. That's a key strategy. And Asayada put this vapor stick up his nose so that he would not fall into the depression. So we do need to sometimes have a strong object or a strong balancing object when trying to pay attention to, when we're taking something like depression personally, that may not be the time to try to notice it, to be with it. If we can recognize it, oh, this is depression, and yeah, believing it's me is happening, and you can stay with that, then that's okay. You know, as long as it's not getting stronger or pulling us in, there is some wisdom that's beginning to kind of work its way in. Patience is really, really important in working with these difficult, strongly identified patterns. Because they will have a lot of staying power to them. It'll take a lot of over and over again meeting it, exploring it, opening to it, to have those insights around it. Yeah. You want to say any more?
Yeah. I was just bringing to mind the reason why Seidel was not looking at the depression directly in the early stages was because he was not able to have the right attitude, right, towards this experience. And so even though we're saying, you know, what is the mind knowing and what's the relationship to it, when we're not able to establish an attitude, right, a stance that feels balanced and observing, the mind often is getting overwhelmed. It's just that object is too entangling for the mind to see the Dhamma. That's when we say to move the attention, do something that allows this wholesomeness of the mind to rearise. The balance of the mind, stable, feels okay to be with what's arising, there's right view. When that's there again, if we're interested, we could revisit that difficulty, right? I know from my own experience, there's some things that my mind will get drawn towards where I feel like I'm being mindful. And it's not until I've actually taken a break from it, allowed my mind to feel peaceful again, that I realize I wasn't really watching with right mindfulness. Right? It was mindfulness with reactivity on some subtle level, some entanglement. So it's good once in a while, move the attention. What else is the awareness knowing? What can it know that just feels easeful? When the mind gets really balanced, you can feel that. We know that. Then we can face something that's an edge that's more difficult.
Would you talk a bit more about delusion? This is always a popular topic. I will just be really brief here. Some of you know I give whole Dharma talks on delusion, you know, hour-long talks on delusion. So there's a lot to say about it and a lot of examples that we can explore to flesh it out. But I'll just kind of give an overview of it, how it works. And it's an exploration, you know, it's a learning. It seems at some level, at first blush, it feels like there's no way that we can know delusion. By its very nature, delusion means that I can't know it. And that's not exactly true. So I'm going to offer a little bit of thoughts about how you might begin to recognize delusion. So the first, I have these kind of talk about three kind of levels of delusion. They get deeper and deeper. So the most obvious kind of delusion is the delusion of non-mindfulness. That's when we're lost in thought. You know, when we're not present, often there is delusion at work. We're not connected from what's actually happening. Our mind is in a world, believing a world of our own construction and not recognizing that it's a world of our own construction. That's delusion. And so that's the first kind of mindfulness. And we see that all the time. Every time we come back into mindfulness, we recognize that our mind had been lost. And there's a little bit of a flavor in that moment when mindfulness returns, a little bit of a flavor of what it was like in the moment or two before for the mind to be caught in a world of its own creation. And so that returning of mindfulness, that moment, the contrast between what it's like to be present now and what it was like a moment or so before to be lost in a world of the mind's creation, that gives us a little bit of a flavor of that kind of delusion. A second level of delusion is related to something I spoke about yesterday, views. So we can be mindful. We can be present, we can be meeting experience, and not aware that we're carrying a view of even something as simple as an agenda, you know, something like an agenda that orients our mind to see certain things and not other things. There was one stretch of time when I was working on pulling the Bermuda grass out of my yard, and at first I had to work really hard to see the Bermuda grass because it was, you know, it's got these little thin leaves. But at some point the mind got really good at noticing the Bermuda grass, you know. It would zero in right on the Bermuda grass. It was like I saw it everywhere. And yet I wasn't seeing everything else, because that's the way a filter works in our mind. It's a function of mind that serves us at times when we have a particular agenda or a particular task we need to do. The mind can orient around information that's useful for that task and screen out, not take in information that's not useful for that task. And so that itself is not inherently delusion, and yet we believe at some level that we are taking in everything. And so if we have an agenda and we're doing something and then somebody says, did this happen, you know, while you were doing that? And you say, no, I was here. I know it didn't happen. And then somebody else says, no, that person actually did walk through. If you hold to your story and say, no, they didn't walk through, you know, this is really delusion at work, where we hold to our views and don't take in that other information. You know, it's like to recognize that our minds have this capacity to screen things out and not connect with things when we are aware. That's a form of delusion. To believe our views are true is a form of delusion. You know, to think that the way I navigate this world is the right way to navigate this world is a form of delusion. You know, it's not recognizing that the way I navigate this world is a conditioned phenomenon. It's one of many ways to navigate the world. And so we often have a filter or a view or a belief that we are not noticing in terms of living our lives. And so we may be aware and knowing, yes, I'm seeing, yes, I'm hearing, yes, I'm, speaking, and yet not be aware of a whole set of beliefs in the mind. That's a form of delusion when we're not aware of the beliefs that are operating. We can begin to become aware of those beliefs, recognizing that I believe, you know, another kind of example from culture, you know, it's like there's certain conventions that people have around how close you stand or whether you touch somebody when you speak or, you know, how much eye contact you make. And, you know, if you are unaware that how you do that when you go to another culture, you know, there may be some discomfort in there. But when you move into another culture, if you're aware of, well, let's see, where does the discomfort happen? Maybe that'll expose some views that I didn't know I had about how human beings interact. So, you know, these are just some simple examples, but views are a big source of possible delusion. But when we can recognize this is a view, it may not be that the view goes away, but at least we know we're operating with a view, which means that there's less of a chance for the delusion to take root in there, less of a chance to believe this is right, that's wrong, this view is true. That's, I think, a big place where views turn into delusion, when we believe our views to be truth, as opposed to recognizing that a view is a perspective. So that's a second level of delusion that operates in our minds. And a third level of delusion is what I would say is more the human level of delusion. You know, this level of views is kind of, it can be personal views, it can be cultural views. The deepest kind of delusion we all share as human beings, no matter our culture. And these are the tendencies that we have as we engage in our activities in life to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what is unreliable to be a reliable source of happiness. We tend to take what is not self to be self. Or another way of framing this, we tend to take what is uncontrollable to be something that I should be able to control. And so those are patterns that we all share. Again, they're hard to see, but you can begin to be curious about what, you know, hearing this, you know, we tend to take what's impermanent to be permanent. It's like, what am I taking to be solid, stable, lasting? A mind state arises. Oh, it's going to be like this for the rest of the retreat. Mind has solidified that. That's the imputation of permanence. Noticing that, again, not necessarily trying to make myself believe it's impermanent, but recognizing the mind is imputing permanence here. Believing that something is, yes, I get that fifth piece of chocolate. I'm going to feel good. You know, that kind of imputing the happiness to the chocolate. You know, noticing that that's what the mind is doing. Recognizing self, studying the self, you know, that what we just talked about. When there, we usually can't just say, you know, I feel we do kind of begin to have a sense of what it's like to have a sense of self, like self-hatred. It was like really clear there was a sense of self in that. I couldn't just say, oh, I see that sense of self. That's not useful. Let me like put it down. But I could begin to recognize this is a believing of this self here. And so that's, again, that's the studying of how we believe or how we align around these misperceptions of experience. And so study what you take to be permanent, where you think things are solid and lasting. Notice that and see what happens to them. Are they actually permanent? How about things that you take to be reliable as a place for happiness? How long does that happiness last? Things you take to be self. Study that sense of self. See what happens. So these begin to show us, you know, the studying of these views begin to reveal to us that things are impermanent. We begin to see that more directly. And then as we begin to, you know, what often happens around delusion, and as we're practicing and beginning to recognize, wow, you know, that mind state that I thought was going to last forever, it lasted 3 seconds. It's gone. So the next time we find ourselves believing a mind state is permanent, you know, we may not be able to, it may not disappear in 3 seconds the next time, but we can remember, yes, I know from my own experience mind states don't last. And that this being caught in believing it's going to last forever, this is delusion. We can know delusion like that. Having seen through it at times, when it comes back, we can remind ourselves, yeah, I know that I'm caught by delusion right now. And you don't have to try to uncatch yourself from delusion. Just know, yep, delusion is operating. This is kind of like the equivalent of the stories in the suttas. You know, often the Buddha would apparently have these encounters with Mara. It's talked about that every time he encountered Mara, and I interpret this psychologically, you know, it's like, I see you, Mara. And Mara is the embodiment of delusion, basically. It's like, I see you, Mara. It's like, and in the stories, when the Buddha said that, Mara immediately vanished. For us, that may not happen. But, you know, you can at least acknowledge, yeah, oh, this is delusion. And if that languaging of, I see you, Mara, is supportive for you, which I found it helpful. Joseph used that as an instruction at one point. When you see something, you know, sticky, it's like, yeah, this is delusion. Yeah, I see you, Mara. And that way it's acknowledging that filter of delusion. And delusion lives and feeds on unawareness. As soon as delusion has a little bit of awareness in there, it begins to lose its nourishment. And so it begins to weaken the power of delusion. To even just name it that way. Yep, I see you. That's delusion. That's delusion at work. That's probably enough. You want to say something about that?
Very thorough. It's funny, I was having this image when you said Mara, you know, the embodiment of delusion. It's like, you know, the Buddha says, I see you, Mara. And we sort of say, we kind of go, I see you, Mara. And then we put out all these cookies for Mara. It's like Santa Claus, you know. It's like, oh, we're going to put the cookies and the milk out and just kind of invite Santa Claus to hang out for a while. And Mara stays around forever. Like, come move in with me. Something that was helpful for me when I heard that, oh, of these three defilements, typically what stands out most easily for most of us and to recognize, not true for everyone, but for most, is we see aversion most easily because it's sort of immediate. The cause of the suffering of aversion is so clear, right? It doesn't feel good. to be in a deeply aversive state. Typically, it takes a little bit more time to then sense why craving leads to suffering, or even to recognize craving, because we're getting things that we want. And so that energy, you know, it took me a while to feel, what does craving feel like and how do I know it? And then delusion just takes time. And every defilement comes with delusion. Every suffering comes with delusion. So it is it will always be there with a unwholesome state of mind. It requires not understanding the way things are. Right? As Andre was saying, we don't see things as they are. We don't see that they're impermanent, that they're just lawful unfoldings. We don't see that. So there's a lot that's sort of rich territory around delusion. Can be just, we'll get to know it. We'll get to know Mara, all of its manifestations on our long journey to Nibbana. I was hoping that would be the last second.
It can be.
We have another. Yeah. We have a few
words. If you have a quick one.
When you discovered greed, craving in mind, how do you get rid of it? With a pitchfork. A really sharp pitchfork. Get in there to the roots. We can't get rid of it. We would get rid of it if we could. Right? We would do everything. We're doing what we can. But what is effective in craving being let go of is that it's understood. We really see that when the mind is filled with craving, it's not peaceful. It needs something else, and that's not rest. It's not restful. So just by seeing, that's how craving will be let go of.
And I'd add, notice the aversion to craving. You know, that here's craving. How should I get rid of it? Well, craving's arising, and not liking craving is arising. You know, that's the attitude. You know, notice that's the wanting to get rid of the craving is actually holding it in place. And yet, you know, when we notice, okay, yep, craving and not liking. Okay, can I hold both of those? So we should stop. Sure. So let's just sit for 25 seconds.